If you're wondering who that stranger is, that is our second son, Joshua, who has spent several months in Brazil and is clearly embracing the culture. He's about to go spend a bunch of time doing road construction, and the next time you see him, well, he'll probably reflect that. But I'm so glad you're home. Missed you a lot. We went out to the airport last night to collect Josh, and his plane was coming in, you know, later than we normally stay up. And so the massive difference between fathers and mothers was demonstrated very clearly last night in our conversation. It's like, oh, it's only an hour until Josh is home. Can he get an Uber? No, we're going to go get him. Why can't he get an Uber? He's got more money than we do. He can take a taxi. No, we're going to go get him. And I'm a little bit disappointed in you, Norman, because he's family, and we do this for family, and I haven't seen my son in 6 months, and we're going. Are you coming or not? Okay. Fine, I'll come. So we go to the airport. And there's a bunch of other crazy people there picking up their family. I think we should support Uber more. Like, just get out of the airport. Why are all these people parking there? Why are they taking up my parking spaces? Why are they in my chair? I want to sit down. Get out of my way. There was a family there. And I got to tell you, for all my silliness, putting it aside, I was getting all choked up. People showing up to pick up their loved ones. There's a fellow there with a big bouquet of flowers. He's just excited to see his wife and other people. But there's this family there, and it's a pretty big family. And they had Canadian flags, and they had signs, and the signs were written in a foreign language, but I could make out it said essentially, "Welcome to Canada." And there was a little girl there. She was part of this big family, and she was just vibrating, and she was running around, and she was going to the part of the exit where you could see through the glass, and then she I don't know how she knew who she was waiting for, but she recognized him. She comes out of her shoes. She's just excited. She's just like, ooh, they're coming, and she's little. Did I mention she's little? She's tiny. Like, if she was in my way, I would have stepped on her. She's just a little human being. She's pushing adults out of the way. She's meeting these people at the door, and every German molecule inside of me is yelling, get out of the way, there's people coming, there's an orderly way to do this. Move along, there's a line. Everybody follow the line, everybody follow the rules. She didn't care. She didn't care. It was her family, and it was them, and they rush, and they embrace, and they clog everything up. But a few minutes later, a shaggy Brazilian walks through that gate, and his mother just lights right up, and his sister insisted on being there, and I was fairly pleased to see him too. There's nothing Gabriella wouldn't do for her children. Nothing. It's quite humbling sometimes. I think I've shared the story about that stroke of genius I had a few years ago about getting her a Pandora bracelet so I'd never have to think again about what to get her for special occasions. We just get her more Pandora charms. Just load that sucker up. And one of the first charms that one of the children bought her was a bear. A bear. She doesn't look like a bear. That's not a compliment. He says, bears make the best mamas. And don't they, though, hey? Mama bears. I love Westerns, and there was a remake of an old Western, and it was 310 to Yuma, and in the remake, Russell Crowe plays the bad guy, and some no-name actor in this scene near the beginning of the movie says something derogatory about his mother, and he shoots him. He stands over him and says, even bad men love their mamas. Even bad men love their mamas. Everybody loves their mom. We all love our moms, just about, mostly. Hey, very rare exceptions. We love our moms. Dads, but moms, absolutely, no question. And yet even in that sentence, I just, again, as I prayed, I just feel the need to acknowledge the women who have just, for whom today brings mixed blessings, for all of the miscarriages and stillbirths and crib deaths and illnesses and accidents and people who very well may go to a graveyard today to visit their child. Or for those of us who might go to a graveyard today to visit our moms. It's a mixed blessing, hey? I met my grandmother, my mother's mother. She's the only grandparent I ever met. Gabriella never met any of her grandparents. And sadly, it's something that our children have in common with us. None of our children ever met any of their grandfathers. They met their grandmothers, but Gabby's mom died 11 years ago. My mom died 8 years ago. And it's just a weird thing when you realize that you're an orphan, you know, that that as far as family structures go, now everybody's looking at you like you're supposed to be the wise person. And you realize, oh, we're in trouble. And then you realize that your parents felt the exact same way. It's kind of humbling. You start to acknowledge that. Motherhood is many things. Mother is a noun. It's also a verb. It's how. All right. Technology's great when it works. Thanks. Here we go, Joy. Everybody say a quick prayer for Joy, because she's going to have to follow along now. And I didn't give her much of a manuscript. Mothering, some people are mothers, some people have mothered, some people have been mothered. But of all the things that motherhood is, it's a responsibility. You are creating human beings, and you're turning them loose in the world, like the little turtles that are trying to get to the ocean. You know, you got to get your turtles there. I think motherhood, for the most part, is pretty rewarding. I think it can be frustrating. I think it can be worrisome. I don't know if any of you have ever worried about or for your children, but Gabby worries about her kids. She grew up poor. I did too, but I didn't know it. but she did, because her father insisted on feeding them liver sausage 24/7, but he figured that's the only thing that anybody really needs is rye bread and liver sausage. Why should we buy anything else? It's the perfect food. You can have it for breakfast. You can have it for lunch. You can have it for supper. So if there was ever a fight, it was about that. But sometimes she worries about money. She mostly worries about her children. Every once in a while, she worries about me. Not in terms of health or safety, just in terms of what I may or may not say. But motherhood is risky, isn't it? Because you have this incredible amount of love for these little human beings. And it can be kind of stressful. It can be. Now, our children were not like me. They actually listened to their parents, but I managed to get lost a few times. Actually, we lost Josh once, but that wasn't his fault. We were at West Edmonton Mall, and he crossed over the way to go look at something else, and somebody thought he was lost, so they picked him up and took him to, of all places, the lost and found. But when I was visiting, like I got to go visit my grandmother when I was little. We went to Switzerland. That's where she lived, and we went to the capital city because that's where she lived, and it was big, and there was lots of stuff happening, and I had to go explore, and sometimes I explored a little too well, and there was a couple occasions where there had to be a little bit of recon for little Normie. There was also the time where little Normie was busy pouting, and he wouldn't get on the elevator, and the elevator doors closed, and we were in the train station, and the elevator went away with my mother and my sister, and all of a sudden, I was very alone. I was very, very happy to see my mom again. Moms just matter. They just do. They are so incredibly important. And I think it's just interesting to see how prominently mothers feature in the scriptures. There's a whole bunch of them there. Eve, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, Jochebed, Hannah, Elizabeth, Mary. And if you look at that list of names, you might be able to say, I know that person's child. I know who their kid was, right? Eve had some kids. Anybody remember their names? Cain and Abel. Not one of the better parenting stories out there, right? But there was also a child of redemption, Seth. Sarah, who did she have? Isaac? Thank you. Who did Rebecca have? Who did Rachel have? Yeah. Who did Tamar give birth to? That's a tricky one. She had twins, and the famous one's name was Perez. Rahab, whose lineage does she feature in? Boaz, yep. Ruth, she was the great-grandmother of David. Who did Bathsheba give birth to? Solomon, there we are. Jochebed, it was in the newsletter. Moses, Hannah, Samuel, Elizabeth, John the Baptist, and Mary. If you got that one wrong, you should probably leave. Not really. If you don't know the answer to that, you're the perfect person to be here. Today's the day for you. Pretty famous moms. But mothers feature prominently in the gospel and really powerfully in the genealogy of Jesus. So we pick up Josh, we get his bags, we're in the car, we're driving back to Edmonton, it's pushing midnight, and we had already arranged previously that he would step in and read the New Testament this morning, and I was thinking we should change it up. We should probably go with the genealogy of Jesus. Then I read the names again, I thought it'd be kind of cruel to do that to him, kind of cold. Oh, by the way, read all these names. But in the Gospel of Matthew, when you read the genealogy of Jesus, what's really, really unusual, super unusual, and something that stands out, is four women get named in there. And that's super unusual for the genealogy. But when you look at the names of those four women that feature prominently in the genealogy of Jesus, it's Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba. And for the sake of the gospel, I think we can even push it back further and talk about Eve. In fact, of all the people we want to talk about today, there's four people of whom significant things are said. And three of them feature in the genealogy of Jesus, but I think by extrapolation, we can easily and very importantly include Eve. Mothers featured prominently in the gospel, Eve. Genesis 3:20 said, Adam named his wife Eve because she would become the mother of all the living. And then of Tamar, the scriptures say, Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I. That's Genesis 38, verse 26, and we'll unpack that in a moment. Thirdly, Ruth, who says to her mother-in-law, Naomi, and remember, she's a Moabite, they're living in Moab. Naomi wants to go back to Israel, and she says, where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. And then Mary, who says to the angel, after he tells her everything that's about to happen to her, she says, I am the Lord's servant. Mary answered, may your word to me be fulfilled. And Keith introduced us to a song, which I went on YouTube and I found and we listened to ad nauseum, but you know, it's is anything too difficult for thee? You know, no, nothing is too difficult. How does that song go? At this very time God is appointed, is anything too hard for the Lord? No, nothing is too hard for the Lord. And this is Mary's story. How can this be? And the angel says, is anything too hard for the Lord? No, nothing is too hard for the Lord. So you think about Jesus, you think about the story, you think about the gospel story, you think about these women who feature prominently in the gospel story, and you would begin in Genesis 3 with the fall. And it was Eve who was deceived. And isn't this a great curiosity then that Adam names her in verse 20, the mother of all the living? Because in fact, it's through Eve and Adam that death comes into creation. That the fruit of sin, death and alienation, it's their fault. They did it. They opened the gate and it flooded in. They ate of the forbidden fruit. They sinned, and that curse rests upon all of humanity. And yet, at the end of the chapter, what does Adam name her? The mother of all the living. And again, this is ironic because one of her sons kills the other son. And you think, where do you get mother of all the living out of all this death and sin and nastiness? But it stems just a little bit higher when God is redeeming Adam and Eve. And even though he's pronouncing this curse, he says of her offspring, your offspring will stomp on the serpent. The serpent will strike his heel, but he will crush his head. And this is a massive foreshadowing. People had mixed reviews and feelings about the movie of The Passion of the Christ. But I got to tell you, the beginning of the movie, when they're in the Garden of Gethsemane and the snake strikes Jesus' heel and Jesus just lifts up his foot and stomps on the snake's head, that's Genesis 3. That is the fulfillment, that is the prophetic fulfillment of Genesis 3, that Satan is ultimately a defeated foe. I want to quote from Gordon Wenham. He's kind of the current Wayne Gretzky of Old Testament scholars. Actually, I think he might be dead. Is he still kicking? Still alive? Wayne Gretzky of Old Testament scholars. He says this of this passage. He says, the long-term effects of sin, there you are. You're one slide ahead of me. There, one back. Thanks. The long-term effects of sin then started to appear. The serpent was condemned to crawl and to constant warfare with mankind. The woman's offspring in verse 15, in that her offspring will crush the snake's head, and the latter will come off worse in the long battle. Thus, though it was a judgment on the snake, it was at the same time a promise to man. It has, therefore, traditionally been seen by Jews and Christians as the first hint of a savior for mankind. And Genesis 3:15 is often called the proto-evangelion, or the first gospel, as allusions to it in the New Testament include Romans 16:20, Hebrews 2:14, and Revelation chapter 12. Despite this terrible situation, there's the hint of and the promise of hope. This is bad, but it's not the end. There's something to wait for. And then you think of the next person and Tamar. It's a story of grace and faith as it unfolds in Genesis 38. Judah, one of the 12 tribes of Israel, one of Jacob's sons, he has a bunch of sons. And he gives the first son gets married to a woman named Tamar. But then he dies. And so in the tradition of the culture and et cetera, et cetera, the second son is given to Tamar, but he dies. And then however many sons Judah has, they all die until he runs up to the last one and like bad track record. So he doesn't want to give his last son to Tamar because all of his sons so far have died. Like, this is bad. We met somebody years ago. I think she was on her sixth husband. I turned to Gabby and I said, you know, like, if you were number four, wouldn't you be rethinking things just a little bit? Like after four, the fifth guy for sure should have been like, no, I'm out. But no, if there was five and then there was six, it was like arsenic and old lace. Like, I don't know. I don't know what it was, but I sure wouldn't want to be seven. Well, Judah's not keen on sending his last son, and she's kind of annoyed, and so she dresses like a prostitute, intercepts him on his way from here to there, and he hires her, and she has a child. Word comes back to Judah, hey, your daughter-in-law Tamar is pregnant, and he wants her killed. How could she do something so treacherous? How could she do something so immoral? How could she do something so vile? And she says, yeah, okay, probably should, but just to let you know, the father of the child, because she secured his signet ring and some other paraphernalia. And she said, just want to let you know that the person who owns these, he's the father. And Judah recognizes his stuff and is deeply shamed. He's deeply ashamed. And that's when he speaks those words that we read a little earlier. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I. You know, whatever it was, she was taking a massive risk. She was. But she somehow believed, I think, that she would be spared. And it's interesting because she had a set of twins. And one of the twins put his arm out. And somebody quickly tied a scarlet thread to his wrist. And he pulled his arm back in. But when they were born, they were able to say, that one was born first. And the one that was born first features into the lineage of Jesus. And what's really fascinating is somewhere in this whole story weaves the themes of grace and faith. That Tamar acted righteously. And I think it's really powerful then when we read later in the New Testament when Paul's talking about Abraham, that he says of Abraham, he believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. That a true faith equates to righteousness. And we read later in Hebrews that without righteousness, without holiness, no one will see the Lord. And there's that just strong relationship between believing and doing. Because ultimately, what we do is probably the purest reflection of what we believe. And you see this play out in the story of Tamar and Judah. And Jesus, of course, comes from the line of Judah. And Judah's not a real noble guy when you read the book of Genesis. And yet, of all the lineage that God could have chosen for the Messiah to be born of, you would maybe think it would be like the Levitical line, Levi, the priests, right? But no, it's Judah. And it's just so important then, because the argument in the book of Hebrews is that Jesus is our high priest, but not like a Levitical priest. He's a priest from the order of Melchizedek, who was a priest and a king who Abraham encountered in Genesis 14. And whose name actually means King of Righteousness. This is Judah. Judah had many failings. And the whole situation with Tamar, messy, messy, messy. Very questionable. And yet somehow, there's grace and there's faith. And I think it's that thread that just plays so prominently. Someone much smarter than I said, Rahab, speaking later on, Rahab, she was a prostitute, a sinner, a stranger, a foreigner, but she saved the spies of Israel at Jericho because she trusted the Lord God of Israel, knowing he had rescued the Israelites from Egypt. In response, the spies promised to save her and everyone in her house from destruction. If she tied, and you're ready for this, get this now, hear this now, if she tied the scarlet cord that let them leave to safety to her window, she did what was instructed of her and her household was saved. There was a scarlet thread tied around the baby's wrist, but we see that same scarlet cord now. It's grown, it's thicker in Rahab's hands as she helps Israel. And because of her faith, Rahab's faith, she's saved, her household is saved. And she ends up becoming the mother of Boaz, who plays, was it Boaz? Obed? I get all messed up with that group. But she precedes Boaz, right? And Boaz marries Ruth. And I think that's the third point of the Gospels. This idea of sacrifice. Ruth chapter 1, where Ruth leaves or refuses to leave her mother-in-law. Instead, she leaves everything she knows, everything she has. You know, it's hard for many of us to imagine leaving everything we have. And yet there's people here, even today, who have left their country, who have left family, who have left jobs, and they've picked up their wives and their wife and their children, and they've moved here to build a new life. And that was my parents' story. You know, 1952, my dad moved here with nothing. And when we were out at Wiesenthal, we met people like that. A lot of the Dutch people that were in the area, they came with nothing in their pockets, and they worked for other people, and they saved hard, and they were able to buy a little piece of land and a little house, and yet they worked hard, really, really hard. We had this one farmer out at Wiesenthal that he never came to church because he didn't think he was good enough to come to church. And yet he and his wife were so faithful to that little church. But Henry would drive from, do you know where Wiesenthal is? It's like Millet, it's south of Leduc. Like it's like a good 10 miles south of Leduc. Henry would drive all the way up to that meat plant that was at Fort Road and the Yellowhead. And he would work. He'd work a full shift. And then he would drive home. And he would farm as long as the sun was up. He worked hard. And they were able to build a life. In fact, they ended up building a really good life. But he had to leave everything to come and do that. And in that, there was a blessing. Ruth just refuses to leave her mother's side. And she had to know that she was a foreigner. She wasn't one of them. We experienced that when we moved from Vancouver to Saskatoon. Let me tell you, that was an education. We were not one of them. We were those people. We're like, they're from Vancouver. You could almost feel them just wanting to spit when they said the word Vancouver. It was like something out of that show Dog River, where there's that competing town, and anytime somebody says that town's name, everybody at Dog River goes, tuh. You know, it's like that in Saskatoon. Where is he from? Vancouver. Tuh. Everybody spits. It's like, ugh, one of them. You're not one of us. And boy, oh boy, did I feel that. In 1997, we moved to Alberta, and you folks are far less discriminating. You welcomed us. You embraced us. But there was also part of me that said, you know what? I belong here because my parents came here in 1952 and 1954, and they built a life. And if I would have been born on time, I would have been born in Alberta. But I was born in BC. Now, as we all know, British Columbians are superior to every other Canadian, especially people from Ontario. So when we came to Alberta, we improved your lot. So you're welcome. You're welcome for that. But that wasn't Ruth's case. Ruth was from Moab. And Moab was, they were not friends. That was not friendly. This wasn't good. Let's just say that. But she goes with her mother, who has nothing. Like, Naomi's husband's dead. Ruth's husband is dead. The other son, he died too. Like Naomi renames herself. She says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because the Lord hates me. And loose paraphrase, but that's the gist of it. Like, everything bad that could happen to somebody has happened to Naomi. And yet she goes back and she says, you know, we have this kinsman redeemer that might help us. And if you follow the story, he ends up marrying Ruth. And one of the things that attracts him to Ruth is her faithfulness to her mother-in-law. That was just powerful to him. And because of who she was and her integrity, he redeemed her. And they had a child who had a child who had a child, and that child was David. But you know, Ruth gave up everything. It's a story of sacrifice. And that's the story of Hannah too. The story of Hannah is not only a story of sacrifice because she gives up her child, but it's also a story of redemption because she couldn't have a child. And if you read through that first part of the chapter, there's this other wife who's just nasty and keeps mocking her and tormenting her because everything. Dan, can you fling me the water bottle that's closest to this side? Thanks. What was I just saying? kinsman redeemer, left everything. Hannah can't have a child, and it was a big deal. It was like a super big deal. It's a big deal now. It was a really big deal, probably even bigger deal back then, because that's where somebody's entire worth came from. But, you know, for the first 5 years of our marriage, we couldn't conceive. And Gabby thought God hated her. She felt like she was under a curse. It was getting harder and harder to go to church. And it was really, really hard if we were around other women who were pregnant. And then it was really, really, really bad if they complained about being pregnant. And Mother's Day was horrible. My mom couldn't have kids, and then one day did. And in some ways, through my mom's story, I can somehow relate to Hannah and her pain. But she's finally blessed with a child. But she makes a deal with God and says, if you give me a child, I'll give him back to you. And we read the story. They're supposed to go up to the temple, and she says, no, I want to stay home, and I want to wean the child. It wasn't simply this pragmatic action of, hey, I just want to wean the child. It was, I want to hold my baby just a little bit longer. I just want to hold my baby a little bit longer. Can you give me that? And Elkanah says, you bet. I can give you that, Hannah. I can give you that. But you made a promise to God. You made a promise. And I think this is probably the hardest part, whether you're mother or father, is to realize that your children are loaned to us. They belong to the Lord. And to give your child back to God and say, he's yours or she's yours. And you can do whatever you want with their little lives. Because we want to protect our children, right? And sometimes God asks the unthinkable of our children. You know, we bless Joshua when he wants to go to Brazil, but those are tough days when he's not home. We actually like him a lot. Daniel was out in Europe over Christmas, and Josh was in South America at Christmas. And I missed Christmas, and it just wasn't Christmas. There was no Christmas 2023 at our house. But for the sake of two people who came and ate supper with their mother, and redeemed the day. And we all have stories to tell, hey, but one of the stories my mom loved to tell was the winter that my grandfather died. Two of her younger boys still felt that they needed to have Christmas, and she said, no, there will be no Christmas this year. But they took her bread knife into the forest and cut down a tree. And these two little tykes dragged it home and set it up. And she just wept. My oma wept. And they had Christmas. This is just what children do. Children help us see the beauty in things. But boy, it's hard. It's hard. You know, Naomi was incredibly vulnerable. Daniel Block says, the death of a husband meant the loss of one's economic support base and the severing of connections to the kinsman structure. Widowhood often meant inevitable alienation and destitution. And Ruth wouldn't let her mother-in-law go through that alone. She was faithful. She sacrificed. And sacrifice is at the heart of the gospel. For God sent his son, and we'll talk more about this next month. And Jesus gave up his life. The King of Kings and the Lord of Lords left all his glory in heaven and came to this to save you. You didn't deserve it. But he loved you. And I'll tell you, it's hard to truly conceive of love until you have a mom, until you're a mom. Because as much as I love my children, I don't think it really compares to the way Gabby loves her children. You know, it's just intense. And children teach us something about the heart of God. And you see this in the life of Mary. We talk about surrender as it plays out in Luke chapter 1, where Mary doesn't know what she's going on, but she accepted it. And you think about what that scene in the manger would have been like with the shepherds coming and saying, hey, guess what? Guess what? We just saw some angels. And guess what? Guess what they told us? And Mary's thinking, huh? Really? For real? And like, that's all well and good. Until 8 days later when they're in the temple and Simeon prophesies over the child and says these powerful words, and a sword will pierce your heart too. There was a question somebody asked me this week as we were talking about this. What was it like for Mary standing at the cross, watching them do to her son what they did to her son? What was that like for her? What was that like for her? You know, and this is the whole thing about surrender and everything else. Your kid says to you, I want to go to the mission field. And you're like, no, you don't. Not right now, you don't. You'll wait until I die, and then you can do what you like. But I cannot wake up every morning thinking that you're eating monkeys and bugs and in grave danger. And I'm assured it's not really like that. But it's like it's not here, you know? It's another part of the world where they don't speak English and where you don't know the rules and you don't know the laws and you're kind of vulnerable and what do? But you feel like God's led you to a place and you want to go and serve him and you think, okay. I think of Ardeth's story about Herman going ahead to Brazil and she's following him with two children in tow. Or I think about Bernie Lemke's testimony about when they went to Africa and they got the two little boys and they're sitting on this night flight out of Paris and they're holding each other's hands, totally terrified and thinking, what do you think your parents were going through? What do you think your parents were going through? And yet we surrender, don't we? We surrender our children, but we surrender ourselves. And we say to the Lord, do what you're going to do. My life is yours. And this is really what Mary says too. And this is all what plays out here and there. So I guess my ultimate question today is, what have we learned? What have we learned today? And I just want to throw this out for you. I want to say that God had and has a plan. He has a plan of salvation. He knows what he's doing. He's got things worked out. I think that is revealed in the life of Eve. I think God can and does redeem our past and provides for the future. And I think that plays out in the story of Judah and Tamar. I think God's salvation unfolded and unfolds in unpredictable ways. And that plays out in the life of Ruth. Ruth thinks she's going to die. Ruth doesn't know who Boaz is. She doesn't know she's going to get redeemed. She doesn't know she's going to get a husband. She doesn't know she's going to have a child. She doesn't know that that child is going to become the grandfather of David, king of Israel. You don't know anything about your kids, do you? I don't know anything about mine. I don't know what they're capable of or what God has in store for them or who they're going to marry and what child they're going to have and what that child's going to end up doing. But I know this. God has a plan. And it's never what I think. God's salvation unfolded and unfolds in unpredictable ways. God's salvation. Are you kidding me? Have you ever thought through carefully the story of God's salvation? Who was the mother of Jesus? Some no-name teenager living in not even the good part of Israel. And she's got to go around telling people what? I mean, this is kind of like the adult part of the service. Hey, I'm pregnant, and I got pregnant by the Holy Spirit of God. I've never actually been with a man. Who's going to believe her? Would you? Would you believe her? Would you believe her? I wouldn't believe her. Well, you can keep selling that at the market, lady, because I ain't buying it. Are any of us believing that? And yet that's what happened. Hey? And you go through that whole life. A Moabite, a prostitute, a woman who dressed up as a prostitute, the person who ate the forbidden fruit. These are the people? Honestly? Like, if Jesus was running for president of the United States and they had to vet his, like, past, it's like, no. Too many skeletons in that closet. And yet that's precisely who. And that gives all of us hope. Because in some way, shape, or form, we all probably have more in common with Adam and Judah and Boaz than we do King David or King Solomon or any of the hoity-toities, hey? And yet here's the word. God uses the most unlikely people to do the most incredible things. And it's God who makes the unbelievable believable. Do you think Susanna Wesley had any idea what her children were going to accomplish? She had a son named John, became an Anglican priest, ended up starting an entire movement. Maybe you've heard of it. Methodism. How many sermons did this man preach, Kurt? 100,000? Something like that? It was crazy. It was like he'd just get on his horse and ride. Like, that's not even a saying. He'd get on his horse and ride. He'd ride from here to there. He went into Wales and he preached so effectively to so many coal miners, they changed their behavior to such a degree, they stopped cussing. It was such a dramatic shift that they had to retrain the pit ponies because the pit ponies were used to all the cussing and the horses wouldn't work. They had to retrain them all because the transformation in these men's lives were so powerful. And when he was done with Wales, he went to Scotland. He went all over the place. He would ride. He would preach. He would ride. He would preach. He was incredible. And he had a brother named Charles who was a hymn writer. Wrote some of the most powerful hymns that we sing. Oh, 4,000 tongues to sing my great Redeemer's praise. All glory to be our God, to our God and King. He writes this song after he thought he was going to die, but he wrote thousands of songs. But do you think Susanna Wesley knew that when she was raising these little boys who were outside climbing on trees and catching frogs and getting in fights with each other? Do you think she ever looked at John and said, there's the father of Methodism? Or did she ever look at Charles and say, you know what, people are going to be singing the songs you write 400 years after you're dead? Do you think she ever thought that? She had something like, what, 11 children? Is that right? Not if that's right. I think it was 11. 11 children. And you know what? You know what she did? She told them about Jesus. I want you to look at the person right next to you right now and say, thanks for telling me about Jesus. If you're sitting beside your mom right now, you turn to her and say, thanks for telling me about Jesus. My mom told me about Jesus. And where would we be without our moms? Hey, these women who always stand by us and beside us, who tell us the truth even when we don't want to hear it, love us none the same. You know, through all these lives, through all these stories, weave the themes of grace and redemption, of faith and restoration. And so we think of and we sing to our Lord and God. Wonderful, the matchless grace of Jesus. But it always strikes me how consistently he demonstrates his grace through the lives of our mothers. And so, yes, today, on the Lord's Day, where we celebrate him, we also celebrate the women who so faithfully and wonderfully wore the magnificent mantle of motherhood. Amen. Keith, would you come and lead us in our closing hymn?